Hello and welcome to another episode of the Southern Plains Podcast. I'm Clay Pope. I'm coordinator with the USDA Southern Plains Climate Hub at El Reno, Oklahoma. And this podcast is a joint venture of the Climate Hub and the Redlands Community College Division of Agriculture, also located at El Reno. Thank you all for joining us today and listening to our podcast episode again. And today on the podcast, we have as our guest, Mr. Gary O'Neill. Gary is the state conservationist with the USDA NRCS in Oklahoma. Gary, we appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us on the podcast.
Thank you, Clay. I appreciate the opportunity to share a few things about conservation.
Well, Gary, we appreciate you again taking the time, and let's just go ahead and get started here. And probably the best place to start is just tell us a little bit about yourself, Gary. How long have you been with the agency? How you got in the agency? Your background? Just tell some of our listeners a little bit about Gary O'Neill.
Okay. Yeah, I've worked for the agency 36 years, native of Oklahoma, born and raised on a dairy farm in Osage County. So agriculture is in my roots, and went to school at Oklahoma State University. Got a degree in agriculture economics and went to work for USDA Soil Conservation Service at that time, right out of school. And I've had an opportunity to work in a number of different locations in the upper Midwest and in the Wisconsin region, working different locations. And actually come back to Oklahoma in 2004 and was named the state conservationist in 2013. But with a farm background, I have a good understanding of the importance of conservation. We always practice conservation on our farming, but it was a little different back then. We also mow board and plowed. We cleaned that field and got ready for the next rain and managed it. We thought that was the best way to get rid of cheat and manage some of our weed problems. But now looking back with some of the things we're doing now with covers and tillage, that probably wasn't the best, but at that time is what farmers were doing and thinking they were doing the right thing for the resources.
Well, and that kind of talks a little bit about some of those changes that have been done. You talked about the conservation that you did on the land back when you were growing up and how times have kind of changed some, and a lot of that is because of the work of NRCS. And tell us a little bit about NRCS and your role here at the agency.
Okay. Yeah, NRCS has roots back to the Dust Bowl. We were established in 35 as the Soil Erosion Service and then later becoming the Soil Conservation Service. And that was all because of the movement from Hugh Hammond Bennett and other conservation leaders on the importance of soil erosion during, of course, that time frame during the Dust Bowl. So that's where the agency started. From there, the agency changed names. It had a name change in 1994 and broadened that soil conservation to Natural Resources Conservation Service. But more importantly, in the 30s, we also had legislation that was passed that established conservation districts, and our agency was attached very closely to conservation districts. And the thought was to have a successful federal program out there in rural America, you needed to connect that to farmers and ranchers and to the rural folks that would be enacting those practices. So the philosophy was to develop a conservation district that was made up of local farmers and ranchers, and that structure is still in place today. And we're still partnering, connected with conservation districts here in Oklahoma. There's 84 districts. We're co-located with them and work hand-in-hand with the conservation districts addressing conservation needs for private landowners.
I'd say that local input and that local buy-in is extremely important to getting work done on the ground, isn't it?
It sure is. And you know, we talk about our services are locally driven, and we use farmers' input through conservation districts. We have locally led meetings where farmers and ranchers can come in and express their concerns about what kind of resource concerns exist in that local community. Conservation districts are connected to the farmers because their board is made up of farmers and ranchers. So we try to help set priorities through the districts and do that locally here in Oklahoma at a county level. So hopefully our programs reflect what the issues are in that local county, and we're trying to address those. And that helps us be more grassroots, locally driven. And then, of course, we're always non-regulatory. This is all voluntary assistance. We still think that the best way to address issues and problems is give farmers and ranchers a little bit of help and they're going to do the right thing and treat those resources most every time.
We know you'd mentioned back in 94 with the name change and how the focus of the agency broadened. You know, it started out with the Dust Bowl as far as, you know, focusing primarily on soil erosion, but it's expanded since then. But with that local feedback, with that change in focus from the federal level, you know, how has that really changed the focus of NRCS on the ground over the last few years?
Yeah, I think when we first started, it was more about addressing soil erosion through technical assistance. Very little financial assistance was available. Once our name changed in 94, we broadened and started working on water quality issues, wildlife, habitat, water quantity, even air quality. So, you know, you can do certain conservation practices and have impacts on multiple resource concerns. And so it kind of broadened our focus. It also allowed us to start partnering with a lot of different groups. We now partner with a number of different groups and organizations here in the state of Oklahoma, and that allows us to, you know, get a little different perspective. Also opens it up to different resources as well. Then along came the farm bills. Farm bill started, you know, in the 85 farm bill and the 2002 farm bill really changed the commitment of resources from the federal government as far as financial assistance. And it went from just as much so much of a technical assistance to now a big array of financial assistance is available, and to the point now where our agency is a $4 billion agency and has a lot of resources available for farmers and ranchers to offset some of those costs of conservation practices and systems. And that kind of changed some of our focus. We still want to provide technical assistance. We want to start that assistance through going out and walking the land with the landowner. But we've got a whole array of programs now that can help provide some resources to offset some of the cost of conservation. And that kind of changed some of our structure. But we still have that relationship with farmers and ranchers that we've always had where we're non-regulatory. We're there to provide assistance. And if they want that kind of a help, then we're going to give them a plan and then try to set them up with some financial help to help put those practices on the ground.
We know, in talking a little bit about working with farmers and ranchers to deal with natural resource concerns and that authority underneath the Farm Bill, you know, one of the things that it seems like, at least from, you know, paying attention to the stuff that's going on the news, we've always had crazy weather in this part of the world. All the Great Plains have. But, you know, it just seems like the weather's been getting a little crazier over the last few years. Underneath that authority with the Farm Bill and helping producers deal with some of these challenges, you know, what are some of the things the agency can do in that area, and what are some of the things that the agency is doing with that authority under the Farm Bill to help deal with some of those extreme weather challenges?
Well, I think a couple things. One is to try to help prepare farmers for those extreme events, and I think the Soil Health Initiative and some of the soil health practices as part of a system gives farmers and ranchers a little more opportunity to withstand some of those drastic changes. Anytime you can capture all the rainfall that you do have and get that in the soil profile, that's really important. And having that soil armored and covered as much as possible helps that. And we're seeing that happen a lot. So I think that's one thing that we're doing, is trying to give some practices, some ideas on how to prepare for that next big event. And then we also have some opportunities when the event happens. Our EQIP program, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, it's not an emergency program per se, but there are some things we've been able to do. For instance, drought, we've been able to provide livestock water and help with some of those issues when we went through some really drastic drought situations in 11 and 12. And then wildfires, the last few years, we've been able to have some special initiatives for wildfire where we're going in and replacing cross-fencing, watering facilities. And in the areas where we've had the fires, it's prairie chicken habitats. We've been able to go in and remove the dead cedar skeletons that still remain there. So there are some things we can do under EQIP and some of those programs. The other program we have is Emergency Watershed Protection Program. Not so much of an individual landowner, but we've been able to work with county commissioners and highway department to help protect roads and bridges and things like that.
We know, and talking a little bit, and I want to come back and really touch on some of those things as far as flooding and wildfire. But you mentioned one thing in that answer about soil health, and just recently there's been some information come out as far as some of the successes that we've seen over the last 5 years in states like Oklahoma and working with producers to make some changes in how they manage their land. You know, what came, and a lot of that is a result of the Ag Census. What are some of those numbers showing as far as the success of the work of NRCS and its partners? I'll take brag a little bit on the hub. We view NRCS as one of our strongest partners, and we've been proud to help with that soil health effort too. But could you talk a little bit about the success that the agency and its partners have had in that area?
Yeah, and it is a partnership, Clay. And the biggest partner, of course, landowners. But we've been very fortunate to get some real innovation on some of our producers and trying different things and doing things. And we've had hundreds and hundreds of field days and demonstrations over the last 5 years to help show some of the benefits of soil health. And when you think about soil health, really, it's pretty simple principles. You want to armor that soil with some sort of residue as much as you can. You want to have something green, something growing year-round as much as possible. You want to have diversity in the crops that you're growing. Move away from a continuous crop production and try to have some of that diversity. And all those kind of things really help when you start thinking of what you're dealing with major fluxes of weather. But we've been promoting reduced no-till and then also cover crops, having something growing out there, and we're seeing a lot of interest in that. The latest census report that just came out last week has shown that we've had a pretty significant increase in the number of farms and the acres of cover crops being grown. In fact, we're in the top 20, I think, in the country in that stat. And then the other big change that we've seen is the reduction in heavy tillage. We're seventh in the country in the acreage reduction on heavy tillage, some of the tilling operations that we used to see. So that's the kind of things we're looking for, and it shows that the work that the partnership's doing here in the state is having an impact, and farmers are trying different things, and they're seeing some of the advantages and benefits to some of these soil health systems.
Well, I was getting ready to say, I've got the press release here in front of me that came out from about the findings from the Ag Census, and seeing nearly a 30% decrease in intensive tillage, 30% decrease in the acres under intensive tillage, and what's even more impressive, an over 51% increase in cover crop acres in Oklahoma. I think that's a real testimony to the hard work of NRCS and the partnership. And, I think that shows that there's some good work being done out there. So, I that's something I think the state can definitely be proud of. And I guess that kind of feeds into my next question, because I know there's been a lot of talk about water quality issues around the United States. And I know your agency, working with the State Conservation Commission, the State Conservation Agency, and those districts and others, have had some success in dealing with water quality. Could you talk a little bit about the track record of the state on Nonpoint and just kind of how that fits in with the work that you do under the authority that you have with those conservation programs?
Yeah, and again, we've got a great partnership in Oklahoma that's had some great successes in the area of water quality. We have the flexibility within NRCS to target some of our financial resources to address, a watershed or an impaired stream. And we've done a lot of that, whether it's through the Illinois River work that we've done, or the Canadian River, or most recently, we've got a water quality initiative down in Little Beaver Creek down in Stevens and Grady County. So, we can target that funds. We can also partner with the Conservation Commission, who implements the EPA 319 program. We can pool our resources together along with the state cost share program that's administered through the Conservation Commission. So we can throw a lot of resources, a lot of efforts in an area and try to make an impact. And we've had some great successes doing that. And again, it's all voluntary, and the producer's willing to make some changes that has impact on water quality. And because of all that, we've reduced over 70 streams that have been delisted by EPA on the 303D report, and that leads the country. So it's a real testimony that if you do the right thing and provide voluntary technical assistance and financial assistance, farmers are going to want to make changes that have an impact on water quality, and that's been a great asset in Oklahoma. The other thing that The other side of that story is the commitment from the Conservation Commission to do monitoring, long-term monitoring. If you're going to tell a story about water quality, you've got to have data to show that you're having a positive impact. And so they've been committed for 20, 25 years to use state funds and 319 funds to implement a long-term water quality monitoring program. And because of that and the partnership we have and the willingness of producers to make changes, we've been very successful in cleaning up some water and taking streams off the impaired list. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we've got a model here that works, and we're going to continue to move forward, expanding our partnerships even more. So I think we'll continue to do that. We've got a system now where we can identify where we think we can have the greatest impact, and so we already know where we want to go next with some of our projects, and are excited about that moving forward with our partners.
Well, and when you do those practices to address non-point source pollution, I say address non-point source pollution, a lot of producers put those practices in place for other reasons, like erosion control or trying to reduce input costs. I mean, it's really showing the multiple benefits that are generated from those practices on the land, isn't it, when you see those water quality results?
You bet. Yeah, there's a lot of practices you can put on that's going to have multiple impacts, and one of the impacts is water quality. You know, if you can keep that sediment out of streams, that's the big thing in our state. A lot of the impairments are tied to sediment particles. So if you can address erosion, and that can be on cropland or even on pasture with rotational grazing and making sure that you're going to have some water quality benefits. And then if you can work with that landowner to keep cattle out of streams, fence that, and put a riparian along those streams, you've really done a lot of good work to armor that and to keep those sediments and impairments out of the water bodies.
And those are doing practices, you know, think about cropland as far as like reducing tillage or even taking highly erodible land and putting it back to product or putting it back to grass and running cattle on it. You know, those are practices that not just have erosion benefits, water quality benefits, but you're also reducing emissions, and through photosynthesis, you're starting to restore some of that organic carbon back into the soil, aren't you?
You bet. All those things are beneficial, and it kind of shows you that this, you know, our soil health initiative, there's not many resource concerns out there that you can't have a positive impact by doing soil health systems. There's so many benefits outside of just what's happening on that field, whether that be wildlife, whether that's, increasing water infiltration so you have less runoff leaving that field. There's just a lot of positive things that can happen when you start looking at soil health systems.
Well, I was getting ready to say, I know we've looked at some of the things as far as the climate change impact, as far as reducing CO2 and other greenhouse gas levels from those soil health practices by doing things that, again, have all those other benefits. So I think that's definitely something that I think we should all be proud of, and definitely is a testimony to the work that you've done here at the agency. But, you know, talking about getting back a little bit on the extreme weather bandwagon, and you talked earlier about heavy rain events, and there's another body of work in Oklahoma that I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, and that's the upstream flood control program. If I remember right, Oklahoma has more of these structures than any other state in the union. Could you talk a little bit about that, and maybe talk why that they're there, and just visit with us a little bit about the PL 566 program?
Yeah, the watershed program come in place in the 50s, and strangely enough, coming out of historic droughts, even within in the 30s and 50s, some of our biggest flooding events came, you know, in the middle of big, long, dry drought periods. So the upstream watershed program was enacted in Oklahoma because of where we situate and the intense duration rainfalls that we have. It really fit what we were looking at back there as some of the problems and concerns that people were dealing with in Oklahoma, flooding primarily. So we had a lot of really aggressive leaders in our state, some of the leaders that really shaped this program nationally. And because of the need here and that leadership, Oklahoma really took off and ran with that program. And like you say, we have over 2,107 flood control structures, more than any other state. 20% of the dams that are across the country in this program are in Oklahoma. So it's a huge program. Those were built with financial assistance from the federal government and then handed off to local sponsors to help take care of those. And in Oklahoma, most generally, that is conservation districts. It's a huge infrastructure, over $2 billion of infrastructure out there. They provide over $96 million every year annually on an average annual year of benefits, damages that would have occurred if those structures weren't out there. So they're a great infrastructure that provides a lot of benefits to bridges and roads, and it protects life and property, something that's really important. But it also keeps sediment out of a lot of the rivers and the large lakes that the Corps built. So they're multi-purpose. They provide municipal water for many places. Over, I think 40 of them provide municipal water for communities, and which is really important and became very important when we went through the droughts in 11 and 12. So they're an important infrastructure. The other side of this story is that most of them were built with a 50-year plan life. So we've got a lot of those, almost two-thirds of them, that are past their plan life. So like anything that gets built, they've got to be taken care of. They've got to be maintained. That takes resources, and the Conservation Commission works with the state legislation along with the sponsors, the conservation districts, to help do that. NRCS provides technical assistance where we can. And then we've also got a new program that was developed 10, 12 years ago, and Frank Lucas, Congressman Lucas, was key to that, is the Watershed Rehabilitation Program. Again, we've rehabilitated 50 of those structures. We lead the country in that program as well. And what that does is it goes back and rehabilitates and restores some of the opportunities in those structures and puts them back to where they've got another 100-year lifespan on them. So that's another really important program that we have. But a lot of people don't know about these structures. We've tried to get the word out, but the other really interesting fact, 9 out of 10 people in Oklahoma live within 20 miles of one of these structures. So they're out there providing benefits, protecting roads and bridges, protecting property, and people need to realize they're there, and we need to make sure we have the funding there to maintain that infrastructure here in Oklahoma.
You know, you think about the flooding that we've seen in Nebraska and Iowa and some of these states. I know Iowa has a sizable number of flood control structures, but you think about a state like Nebraska and where that huge impact was. And you'd mentioned about how it seems like our droughts are always broken by a huge rain event. You know, the drought, the Hammond flood and the Dust Bowl back in the 30s. And then, of course, the drought of record was in the 50s until the big rainfall that happened then. And, of course, then the drought of 2011 to 2015 was broken by what's now the record rainfall event in the history of the state. I think 2015 was the wettest year ever in the history of the state of Oklahoma and Texas, breaking that what's now the drought of record. And you look at the damage up in a state like Nebraska, and then you think about the rain, the similar types of rain events that we had that we didn't see that amount of flooding. It really puts the value of that program in perspective, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I mentioned on an average year they create about $96 million, but in 2015 that number was $280 million. So just think about all the damages that didn't happen because these structures were in place. And the way they work is they hold that water during a big events, and then they release it slowly as the water starts going down. So it keeps that high flow from happening. And again, we have 2,100 of those across the state, almost 1,000 of them up and down the Ouachita River. So it's a big deal in our state and something we're really proud of. And it was because leaders and partners in our state that, knew this was important and went after those resources, and landowners gave those land rights. You know, they've got to give up land to allow these structures to be built. And so it took a partnership ever between landowners and the agencies. And the other exciting thing is the new farm bill that was just passed has funding for new construction of these kind of projects again. And we've got over 330 of them that were planned but never built. And so we hope that this new funding will be an opportunity to get some more of these in some places where we weren't able to build because funding had dried up. So that's another exciting story about this program, is that there is now new money available. And we have sponsors and some projects in place that we're going to be you know, putting in project proposals for that, for those monies.
Well, shifting a little bit from flood and talking on another extreme weather event real quick as far as wildfire, and just touch real quick. We you know, with some of the changes we've seen in the weather patterns in Oklahoma, it seems like, you know, we've been getting a lot more rain in late July and August than we traditionally have, and extending that growing season for that forage on through the year. And that's great as a cattle producer, but that also means you've got additional fuel for fuel load for wildfire when you get into the spring months. And I know that's something your agency's dealt with. You've touched a little bit on it to begin with, but you might talk a little bit about that and also some of the prescribed firework that the agency does, you know, because it sounds kind of trite to say it, but that old adage of fighting fire with fire does have a lot of truth to it, doesn't it?
It sure does, Clay. And I think in Oklahoma, we probably lead the country in local prescribed burn associations, and we think that's a really important component of getting fire put on the ground. Those associations can actually help with developing a burn plan and then actually helping a landowner do the burn. And yeah, a lot of landowners are scared of fire, but when it's done properly, it's really an effective tool. And one of the big things that we try to address with prescribed fire is the cedar. You know, you can manage cedar and maintain cedar and keep that cedar off your land with fire. And then also, it's just really a good practice for that grass. You know, our natural prairies used to burn. Mother Nature did that through lightning strikes, and we've kind of taken that away from the landscape. And so prescribed fire is something that's really important, and we provide that assistance through our local staffs, and we work very closely with landowners, but also the local burn associations and Oklahoma State University and some of our partners. So it's an important tool, and one that we're promoting even more. And even last year, coming out of the wildfires, we were talking to landowners about, you know, follow-up burns, and we've gotten several of them that are interested in that. So it is an important tool of managing that wildfire potential. Like you say, sometimes people don't think that makes sense, but it really is. It's a tool to help the wildfires. And, you know, the big thing we have is the cedar. Cedar everywhere, and we're, you know, we have in our EQIP program, we do provide mechanical removing of cedar, but prescribed fire is a big way to maintain that so they don't come back.
Well, and just to kind of put in a plug to NRCS and the Hub are partnering together on a project, again, with Redlands and Oklahoma State as well, where we've got a fire training school coming up on May the 11th in Woodward, Oklahoma. We're getting burn associations and volunteer fire departments and just private landowners to got together to talk about this, how we can get ahead of the curve. And I just wanted to put a plug into that because that is another thing that your agency and, of course, the folks I work for are working together on, and we appreciate that partnership. You know, it's kind of getting close to the end here and going to wrap up a little bit, but probably the last question I'd leave with you, Gary, is just looking forward with NRCS and looking to the future. What are some of the challenges that you see to the agency, and what really does the future for conservation for Oklahoma and the Southern Plains, in your opinion, look like?
Well, I think there's continued challenges. We've got resource concerns in this state that we're trying to deal with, and I mentioned cedar. The positive side is we just have a new 2018 Farm Bill that's in place. The conservation title is extremely strong. A lot of good funding, a lot of programs. All the programs that we had available in 14 are available again in 18, and that'd be EQIP and Conservation Stewardship Program and our easement programs as well. Plus, we have some new programs that was established in the 14 Farm Bill that deals with regional conservation partnership programs, so it gives more opportunities for partnerships. So there's a lot of opportunity, and the future is bright about some of those opportunities. Some of the challenges that we're dealing with is our staff numbers are down, and so we have restructured as an agency. We've always been county-based. We staffed our workforce in the field based on counties, and our number had gotten to the point where that was really difficult to do. So we've now set up teams, and they're multi-county teams, and so that gives us the opportunity to pull a staff together and work on an issue, whether it's a wildfire or some big issue that might come in. We can bring a team of staff within that group of counties and try to address a big workload. And we see that with some of our programs, some CSP in the past. We've got counties that had huge interests, and we've got to pull together a pretty good staff to come in and be able to work on that. So we've set that up, and we think there's some positives to that, and we're excited on where the future holds. We're not taking anything away from a county. We're still doing everything county-based, but our staffing is now set up in teams that are multi-county so they can, you know, jump in and do some things as needed. But the programs that we have in place are a good opportunity. The other exciting thing that we're starting to talk about is in the new Farm Bill, there's an opportunity for a feral hog pilot project. That's another issue we deal with in Oklahoma. And so there's some money available for APHIS and NRCS to work with our stakeholders here in Oklahoma and develop some proposals where we can start demonstrating how we might be able to reduce the number of that invasive species in some of our areas. And it's not enough money to address the problem as a whole, but I think it's a way that we can start working together with landowners to figure out how we might be able to start managing the number of these species that are causing damages and just a real nuisance for farmers and ranchers here in Oklahoma. So that's in the Farm Bill. And I mentioned the watershed program. The other thing is I see a lot more flexibility to pay for certain things and do more in soil health arena. We're working closely with RMA to make sure that there's not crop insurance issues when we start talking about growing covers and ensuring that's not impacting farmers and ranchers. And so there's that opportunity. And then there'll also be ways that we can pool and target our resources to address things like water quality. And we've done that in the past in Oklahoma, and we want to continue to do that, whether it's, you know, water quality issues in the Northeast or some other area, or even water quantity issues. I think we'll be able to pull some of our funding together and work with partners to help landowners. So I think the future is bright for our agency, and obviously with the 18 Farm Bill, there is a lot of support for private lands conservation at the national level, congressional level. You know, with times as tight as it is and in the constant desire to reduce government and spending, that conservation title shows that there's a lot of people that support what our partnership does working with private landowners to address conservation. And so I think moving forward, that will prove to be even more beneficial.
Well, Gary, thank you very much. Is there anything that you want to add before we wrap up and put an end to this episode of the podcast?
Well, I might mention we just opened up a conservation stewardship program sign-up. So it started last week. It goes through May 10th. CSP's been around for several years. It's a five-year contract. It allows a producer to be rewarded for some of their stewardship and conservation work they've done, and then to select some enhancements to even take their operation to a higher level of conservation. So that program is available in 19 again, and the sign-up's just happening now. So if you haven't went in and signed up, I encourage you to go into our field office. I think the program will look much different in 20. The Farm Bill is requesting some changes being made in that program. So I think in 20, the program will probably look a little different. But for 2019, it's basically the same program that was rolled out the last few years just because of timing. But it's available, and, you know, farmers need to go in and sign up before the 10th to be eligible for that program.
Well, Gary, thank you very much. Thank you for taking your time out of your day and visiting with us. And we appreciate each and every one of you listening today for taking time out of your day and sharing a little time with us on the podcast. Again, this has been the Southern Plains Podcast. We are a project of the USDA Southern Plains Climate Hub, which is a joint venture of the USDA's Agricultural Research Service at Fort Reno, and the Redlands Community College Division of Agriculture, also located in El Reno, Oklahoma. We thank you for taking your time out of your day being with us, and we hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you.